Good to go. All right. Well, a call to order the special meeting of the Historical Preservation Commission for Curie Beach here on Wednesday, January 6, 2021. This is a special meeting. The purpose of the special meeting is to discuss the proposed design guidelines, I guess preliminary design guidelines, and the certificate of appropriateness process. Before we do that, what I thought I would do, since we might have a number of people online that are not familiar with what we've gone through for the last year and why we're doing this, is maybe take about 5 minutes and do that, and then turn it over to Mr. Eldridge to get us started and walk through the proposed or preliminary design guidelines, which is the basis for the discussion tonight. Just very quickly, again, I'm going to make this relatively short for the folks that aren't familiar with why we're doing this and why we're here, is that if you actually look at the existing land use plan for the town of Curie Beach, which is fairly old right now, but there certainly was a lot of discussion about trying to maintain the family-oriented ambiance, if you will, or feeling, particularly in the downtown area, but certainly for all of Curie Beach. In addition, there's been a number of surveys done of citizens. The most recent is what is called the Sawyer Study, and they asked several questions, and I've got three right here. One of the questions asked of the residents in Curie Beach was, what do you like about the Curie Beach Business District? The number one response was the small town feel, the quaintness, the old-timey atmosphere. Another question in this survey was, how important are the following to improve the business district? And they listed a number of things. And the number one was to retain the historic character of the business district. And then the third one is a question was, how should the business district look in terms of community appearance? And the number one response of the residents were adopt architectural controls to achieve a beach theme. So with that in mind, about a year ago, the town council asked the Planning and Zoning Commission, the P&Z, to look into ways of kind of retaining the ambiance of the downtown area and so forth. And what we did is we learned very quickly that, unlike most states in the United States, most states you can set up architectural boards that can review a particular area without having to go through a lot of issues, but in the state of North Carolina, under North Carolina laws and statute, is that you can't do that. There's only one mechanism by which you can do any sort of architectural design guidelines and control, and that is what is called establishing a historic district. Now, so it's an either-or sort of state. Either you establish a historic district or you can't really look at any architectural type of design issues and control it. For business and business districts. So to establish a historic district, and it's somewhat of a misleading term, as we've discussed many times, is that when the state put it in place, they allowed a fairly broad definition of historic district. It's not just simply historic. It can also include ambiance, character, you know, and a number of things like that that can be examined and adopted through the historic preservation type of process. Currently, I mean, it's a fairly common thing because there's, according to the website of the state, there's over 700 of such districts right now in the state of North Carolina. I think Wilmington alone has 7 or 8 districts, so it's a fairly common way of doing it. In fact, many of the districts do not even use the word historic in it. They use preservation and things like that. So what we've actually done is call this downtown historic and preservation district is what we're talking about. However, in establishing a historic district, the state requires a fairly complete and certainly a very specific process. And under the guidance of Mr. Eldridge, our attorney, we've gone through that process. There's really 3 steps that are required. One is that you have to designate or have the area designated as an historic district. And again, based upon the council's comments and direction, they wanted us to limit ourselves to simply the B1 district, which is the downtown district for the historic district. And this is what is called an overlay district. But there is a process for doing that, and we have followed that very carefully in terms of finishing up with our designation report that was provided to the council during the last council's meeting. There's 2 other requirements, however. One is that to have a historic district, You need to put together what are called design guidelines. Design guidelines can be very, very complicated. We've probably looked at about 50 or 60 different historic districts, and they can range anywhere from extremely complicated 100-page documents that detail every type of material that could be put into a district versus relatively short and broad type of guidelines. And as you will see, we've taken the latter approach in terms of that, very broad and very flexible guidelines, since that's certainly been the philosophy here in terms of putting together various ordinances. The second requirement that needs to be done with that process is to develop what is called a certificate of appropriateness process. Because when anybody wants to do anything, if it's established as a historic district, it has to go through a review process, and if it's a significant type of change, there has to be a certificate of appropriateness based upon the design guidelines issued by the Historic Preservation Commission. So we have done the first thing. We've put together and gone through the process of putting together a designation report, which again has been passed on to the town council. And what we're here tonight is to look at the design guidelines and the process. Now, just focusing on that, about 2 months ago, we started working on the design guidelines based upon comments by the Historic Preservation Commission, which are the same members as the Planning and Zoning Commission, that we eliminated a number of the guidelines that were more specifically oriented, such as you had to retain the historical materials and things like that. And we ended up with about maybe about 2 pages of guidelines. This was then passed on to Mr. Eldridge, who performed his legal magic on it and has put together a preliminary document. And should point out there's been no vote on this. The purpose of this meeting tonight is to get input from the public and from the council members and from the commissioners and anybody else who wants to regarding the design guidelines as well as the process. So that's why we're here tonight. And so this is simply in discussion. Everything is preliminary. And again, we have not voted to pass anything on yet to the town council. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Eldridge to perhaps walk us through the design guidelines, the preliminary ones as proposed right now.
Thank you, Chairman. Jim Eldridge, town attorney. Want to expound upon the chairman's remarks just slightly. The first thing is he's absolutely correct. It's a three-step process. You develop a designation report, which is reviewed by the state and eventually adopted by the HPC, Historic Preservation Commission. That part has been done. The remaining two parts kind of go hand in hand. One of those is to review to publish on the HPC level. When I say HPC, I mean Historical Preservation Commission. They're responsible, that board, that body is responsible for adopting the design guidelines. At the same time, you develop zoning regulations for the historic, for in this case, preservation, downtown preservation historic overlay district. Those actually go into Chapter 15 as zoning amendments, zoning regulations, which overlay the B1 district's regulations. And Planning and Zoning Commission will review those text amendments tonight during its regular meeting. I mention all that because it's important to understand at the beginning that the design guidelines are simply that, guidelines. They're not the regulations. They're not the zoning provisions. But they go hand in hand with those.
If I can interrupt real quick, I forgot to mention that the design guidelines just deal with exterior. They do not address any interior type of issues.
I'll cover that.
Okay.
Staying with the title for just a second, there is a tendency to refer to these standards as guidelines. That's because that's what they were always called, until the legislature rewrote Chapter 160A into Chapter 160D. Now those guidelines are known as standards. Personally, I like the former text better, guidelines, because it gives you a better sense of how these guidelines and standards are applied. Again, they're not the zoning regulations, they're not the zoning requirements. They are guidelines to be used when any changes are proposed for exterior features on buildings and structures in the historic overlay district, which is the B1 district. So let me say that again. The Chapter 15 zoning regulations and these design standards only apply to proposed changes to exterior features on buildings and structures within the B1 district, this being an overlay district on top of that B1 district. As such, if some action or use or activity in the B1 district is proposed and has nothing to do, will not result in any changes to the exterior features, none of this applies. That type of activity is unregulated under what we're doing here tonight. In addition to work that doesn't apply under these standards, we've also carved out minor work versus major work. Chairman is right, major work, major changes to existing exterior features require a certificate of appropriateness, which is granted or denied by the HPC as the result of a quasi-judicial hearing where the applicant who's proposing those changes has to come in and has the burden of producing evidence showing that the changes proposed meet the standards and the other regulations that we'll get into at the PZC level. So it's not an arbitrary decision. Somebody proposing changes to the exterior features has to show HPC within the context of these standards and some criteria set forth in the zoning regulations that what I want to do meets the feel and look and characteristics of the B1 district as it currently exists. And I think that's another important feature I want to mention here at the beginning. It's not, Chairman is right, we purposely developed a brief, broad, and very general set of guidelines in lieu of establishing a very detailed, specific list of requirements with regards to colors, materials, architectural detail, you name it. Things that you would see in Old Wilmington, things that you would see in Moorhead City and Beaufort, which has historic districts that are defined primarily by late 19th century architectural details. We don't have that here. So the question is, when somebody proposes changes to an exterior feature, they have to show, essentially, with the help of these guidelines or standards, and within the help or the guidance presented by the zoning regulations, that the changes are harmonious and consistent with the look and feel and characteristics and ambiance and atmosphere of the B1 district that if you walked around today lends itself to. You can find a written articulation of what makes the B1 look and feel like it does in the designation report, which I'm sure is another tool that applicants will use as well as the commission in determining the appropriateness of any particular exterior feature changes. But it essentially comes down to what's proposed being consistent and harmonious with the B1 neighborhood that you see today. That's what it comes down to. And that's a function that should be easy for HPC to fulfill. As an example, town council performs that comparison and review every time it rules on a special use permit. One of the requirements for a special use permit is that the proposed special use is consistent and harmonious with the neighborhood. Town council does that without the benefit of guidelines and review criteria. HPC will have the benefit of very flexible and broad guidelines and review criteria. So that's the process. In addition to work not involving exterior features not being regulated, we also carved out minor work which does not require an applicant to come before the HPC to get a COA, a certificate of appropriateness. minor work as defined in the regulations and as listed as simply examples in the standards is administratively approved by the building inspector, thus streamlining quite a few steps. So with that in mind, just want to briefly walk you through. We'll go to page 3 of the standards. Starts off with the preface, Article 1. Which comes after the table of contents.
Yes, it's coming. The computer's broken. Sorry.
While you're setting that up, again, if there's anybody on the phone or listening to this, the HPC did post, I believe the town clerk posted a copy of what we're looking at, I think, on the web page. Is that correct?
I believe Beth did,
yes. Yeah, Beth did. Okay, so.
They can't find it. They can email me and I can send it to them.
Yeah, so again, you could email us or email Mandy. And we can send it to you, but it is available probably about for the last week and a half or so on the on the link.
The agenda is set forth on the website, so you can link that and pick up the materials as well. I want to say one more thing before we get into the document. I'm going to go through the document quickly so we can get into the public comment. Building Inspector John Batson commented on these standards and raised several good points and issues that should be addressed in order to achieve a proper understanding of these standards and how they work. What I propose to do is to use John's comments as talking points, but I want to save that for the regular meeting so that we can get the public comments during the special meeting that we're having right now. I'll open the regular meeting on that agenda item by walking through the standards again, focusing on the comments that John has made, because they do represent very good talking. Preface is simply setting forth the policy that the chairman has already referred to, that North Carolina recognizes that some neighborhoods have a special quality, and the statute is very fuzzy and soft with the requirements. It uses words like look, feeling, atmosphere, spirit, sense, unusual words for a legal document, but nonetheless, that's what constitutes the requirements for a historical district. And there's no doubt that there is a small town, family-friendly charm to Curie Beach, which is expressed primarily in the B1 district. And if you read the designation report, you would pick up on those themes quite readily. And that's why we are where we are today. Of course, the design standards only apply to exterior treatment. Chairman, I did mention that in the third paragraph. It may be that we could word that a little more expressly, but these only apply to proposed changes, minor or major, to the exterior features of the buildings and structures within the B1 neighborhood. I think it's important to realize, although we are setting up a historic overlay district, we're really trying to preserve the look and feel of the B1, I'm not going to call it district, the B1 neighborhood. That's really what we're trying to do, and I think that's if you can put yourself into that context, it's a lot easier to understand what we're trying to do. I thought it was appropriate in Article 2 at the bottom of that page to set up procedures for amending these standards if it comes to that. Again, that's another point that I'll address in the regular meeting. If you go to page 3, you start picking up the required approvals. Section 3.1 CO, Certificate of Appropriateness Required, that's straight out of the statutes. Everything we're doing is heavily regulated and provided for and set forth in multiple parts of Chapter 160D. Rather than have staff or an applicant try to bounce all around that very comprehensive, very detailed, very dense set of statutes, which to some degree are represented in the zoning regulations, PZC will review, I thought it would be more user-friendly to, in a more general and in a more summarized format, to put this information in the standards. These standards are going to be an easily accessible document and user-friendly for both public use and staff use for people proposing changes to the exterior features. So in general, COAs are required, and the language under 3.1 comes primarily straight from the authorizing statute. 3.2 is a big exception. Minor work is accepted. Minor work on exterior portions as defined in Chapter 15 zoning, and that's a reference to the zoning requirements that PZC will look at later tonight, may be administratively approved by the town's building inspector without a COA hearing, but there does need to be some accountability. There needs to be a written request for that so that there's a paper trail. There needs to be a written decision on that so that there's a paper trail. And there needs to be the right for the applicant to appeal the denial so that he gets due process rights. And that's simply what we've set forth in the second paragraph under 3.2. And that appeal would come to the HPC because by statute it needs to come to HPC. It's administrative approval that by statute comes back to you all if it ever came to that. But minor work on exterior portions, I provided a list. It is not an inclusive list. It's a list about limitations. You can read that for yourselves. It's easy to understand. If you go to page 5.
Just very quickly, in case there are some folks on the phone that don't have it in front of them. What we're talking about with minor work, and I'm just going to read a couple from the list. You have a list of about 25. Things like painting, provided it complies with the standards, replacement of window glass, caulking, weather stripping, installation of window air conditioners, as long as they're appropriately screened, removal of dead, diseased, dangerous trees, replacement of missing or deteriorated siding, trim, roof shingles, and these type of things. So,
well, Chairman, let me give a few other examples.
Okay, sure.
To further the understanding of what we're trying to do here. Subsection G, repairs to walkways, patios, fences, and driveways, which are exterior features as defined by the authorizing general statute, so long as those replacement materials match the original materials. Likewise, replacement of missing or deteriorated siding, trim, roof shingles, etc., provided the replacements match the original materials. Take those two examples. Those are proposed changes to exterior features, but because they are relying on using materials that match the materials that you're changing, then the spirit and look and feel of the D1 neighborhood is furthered by using the materials that match the original materials that you're replacing. And that's sort of what, in a nutshell, that's what this is all about. That's why that's minor work, because although you're doing work on an exterior feature, and it is therefore subject to the guidelines and therefore subject to the zoning regulations, it's minor because the proposed change should end up matching what was there originally, hence administrative approval, hence how these guidelines and standards are designed to work.
Just very quickly, looking at probably about 50 or 60 other districts and their design guidelines, every single one separates minor from major that we could find. So it's a fairly standard, very standard process to identify minor, keep that away from the quasi-judicial process of having to go before a board, and simply give the right to the building inspector, whoever may be the appropriate person, to go ahead and issue the permit to do that.
No one is trying to make the use of the property and the maintenance of the property burdensome. But we are trying to preserve the look and feel that ever since 2006, the public has been adamant about preserving. And let me just say one thing. I've lived in beach communities from Massachusetts to Virginia Beach to the Outer Banks all my life. This town is remarkably lucky that the B1 district looks like it does today.
And I will guarantee that if nothing is done to preserve that looking feel, it'll go away. It'll be lost. So that's what we're trying to do here. Page 5, we get into section 3.3. Procedures for non-minor work. This is essentially the COA process. Let me say one other thing about minor work. And this is just FYI for staff if we get there. I found a very simple application by a town in Massachusetts for applying for minor work approval. It was a one-page document. Very simple. I've got that in the document bank if we ever need to get there. Paragraph 1, you have to apply for the COA, pay the fee, and use the forms provided for that. Turn that into the building inspection department. You'll see more of these procedures when we get to the zoning regulations. But in summary, in the second paragraph, and again, these are the references to Chapter 160D. So if we're going to do these things, we have to comply with the very detailed statutes. The HPC hearing shall be noticed and conducted in a quasi-judicial manner in accordance with the provisions of 160D-406. The applicant must show on the basis of the application and the other materials that they want to put into the record that the proposed changes to the exterior portions comply with these standards. Third paragraph, again, right out of the statute book, all decisions by HPC in granting or denying a COA are appealed to the Curry Beach Board of Adjustment. So that's also important to realize. The due process rights are here for the applicant, regardless or any other interested party for that matter. And then we get to Article 4 in the last third of page 5, and for the next two pages. And these are the standards. These have existed. I changed very little. These are the standards that Chairman Galbraith actually drafted and began circulating at least 2, maybe 3 months ago. I made very few changes to these, and it's something that we all are familiar with.
If I could jump in too, again, I'm a big fan of not reinventing the wheel, and so many of these standards and the wording actually comes out of the Raleigh Historic District standards. I mean, there are some unique ones, obviously, so they came actually from two sources. One was the Raleigh, in terms of some of the wording, as you can see here. As well as, I believe that there were a few originally that came from the Secretary of
Department of Interior.
But Department of Interior, that we were shown by the state as a recommendation to start the process. And we changed some of them to reflect more of a district versus a historical property. But those are actually the ones that, based upon the comments of several members of the commission last month, we actually eliminated. So these are primarily, the wording is very similar to what you see in Raleigh.
So let me just touch some highlights when we get to the public comments. General standards applying to both commercial and residential. The erection, alteration, restoration, or relocation of any exterior portions should have the look and aesthetic feel of a 1940s to 70s building, and not be of modern or expressionistic design, those terms being defined in the next two paragraph. Exterior portions should be compatible and harmonious with the other exterior portions within the district in terms of scale and design. Inappropriate modernist or expressionistic architectural design include, but are not limited to, construction consisting of or containing predominant glass elements, glossy materials, round window features, exposed steel elements, broad roofs, or exaggerated overhangs. There's an example that always comes to my mind, which I think is instructive, but since I'm speaking to the public as well, this is not a criticism at all. It's a comparison and contrast for illustrative purposes. We all know the all-glass house on Fort Fisher Boulevard. If somebody came in and proposed a structure like that for the B1 neighborhood, the question is that consistent with and harmonious with the other buildings and structures within the neighborhood? Based on these standards, I think it'd be a clear indication that it's not. So if you walk around the B1 neighborhood and you look at the residential structures and you look at the restaurants and the other commercial structures, you want whatever's being proposed to be consistent with and harmonious with, not in contrast to, what you've got in that neighborhood today. We have specific, some of the general standards also run over to the next page, which Mandy's got up there. I want to focus on B for a minute. Colors is often a very disputed item in determining appropriateness for historic districts. We've tried to eliminate the potential for dispute by simply going with a general standard while ruling out franchise operation type paintings, banded, striped paintings, pattern paintings. Again, the key is harmonious and consistent. Walk around the neighborhood and see what's there. Somebody's going to put a bright neon orange house. Is that paint? Their house, that color, is that consistent and harmonious? That's what it comes down to. You can get lost in these standards. You can parse them like you want. You can make them as detailed in your analysis as you want, or you can make them as brief as you want. You can argue that the regulations are burdensome, but at the end of the day, it simply comes down to, are the proposed changes consistent and harmonious with what's there right now? It's as simple as that. And it's not the burden of the HPC or the Building Inspections Department to make that determination. It is the burden of the person or entity proposing those changes to show you that it's consistent and harmonious. There's additional standards set forth for commercial buildings and additions. That's, again, Mandy's got that. Couple of examples, and the chairman might want to elaborate a little bit. There should be no drive-through, curbside, or takeout operational services, provided that walk-up service windows shall be permitted. B, new and renovated commercial buildings and structures shall be designed so that a pedestrian's experience of the district's unique character, and you can say B1 neighborhood, character, atmosphere, and sense of time and place is maintained. Again, subjective anecdote, when we were working on the designation report before we hired a consultant to help us with that, and I've been with the town 7 years, and I've always heard small town family friendly, but it wasn't until I walked around the B1 district to see if I could articulate what I was experiencing before we hired the consultant, and that's when I was struck by the charm and the uniqueness of that neighborhood. So it really is something, and I experienced it as a pedestrian, so I understand subsection B. A kind of sums it up. A new and renovated commercial building shall be designed with a scale compatible with the special character and ambiance of the B1 neighborhood, and shall utilize details and elements that will help to integrate that structure into the character of the site and the district. Again, you can parse that language, but it's all about consistency and harmonious, which again, council handles every time it looks at a special use permit. I do want to draw your attention to 4.3 on the top of page 7.
Before we do that, can I go back to 4.2E? This we put in because right now on K Avenue we already have an overlay district which allows for mixed use. And the idea of mixed use is that you have a commercial activity on the first floor, and then the second and third floor you can have a residential type of activity.
Like Mayfair.
Yeah, exactly. And so what this basically does with E, it says all buildings on K Avenue between Atlantic Avenue and Fort Fisher, again, which should just be that one block area right there, shall be commercial in nature. While mixed use uses are permitted from multiple story buildings, the first floor of any such building shall be in commercial in nature. So essentially what this does is extends the mixed use opportunity all the way down K Avenue.
That also reminds me to make another comment. It is interesting to note that in the K Avenue mixed-use overlay district, that the overlay district regulations override the underlying district regulations. And in the overlay district regulations, any use that is permitted in that mixed-use overlay district is by special use permit only. So that means council, anytime somebody proposes a use, any use in the mixed-use overlay district, has to conduct a quasi-judicial hearing and rule on the application of that special use permit, which again, one of the requirements is that the use be harmonious and consistent with the rest of the district. Specific standards for new residential buildings and the structures, same idea. New buildings and structures designed with a scale consistent with the special character and ambiance of the district, same language. I did want to point out a possible mistake on my part based on a misunderstanding that we'll need probably now or in the regular meeting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines down in the middle to the end where it starts in this regard. It was my understanding that, first of all, residential use in the B1 district is non-conforming. Under the non-conforming provisions, you can extend that use, which normally would kill non-conforming status. You can extend that use in terms of the footprint of the structure, but the extension of that use is nonetheless limited to single-family residents. So in the B1 district right now, you cannot extend the non-conforming residential use to two and multi-family structures. There was some meeting where I walked away with the understanding that it was the consensus to allow for multifamily extension of use in the B1 district via the overlay regulations. But I could be totally wrong on that, and that's where I need some guidance from the board, from the commission. Again, in the interest of time, maybe we can take that up in the regular meeting. But again, you've got additional standards for additions in 4.4. Again, you're just trying to maintain the look and feel of the district. I also want to point out 4.5, relocation, demolition, and destruction of buildings and structures in the district. What I've got there right now comes right out of the statute, but it's And in point one, point two, it's important to realize that the general statutes say that an application for a COA to relocate, remove, or demolish a building or structure shall not be denied. So if somebody wants to relocate, demolish, or destruct, they still got to get a COA. But it can't be denied. With that in mind, I would recommend, and again, we'll take this up in the regular meeting, that 4.5 from top to bottom be complete, most of it deleted, and simply be worded to state that a COA for relocation, demolition, or destruction shall not be denied. Just make it sweet, short and sweet. Chairman, I'm taking up too much time. We've got to get to the comments. I'll let you wrap up the...
Sure, that's fine. Again, this is a special meeting, and the purpose of the special meeting is to allow the public to have comments regarding the design process or the design guidelines as well as the process. So I'd like to open it up if anybody is on the phone that wants to speak. You hit *6, and if you could... announce who you are and your address for the record, that would be great. So I will let Mandy manage that process. Is there anybody that...
I have a couple of people on. Again, *6 to unmute yourself.
Is there anybody? This is, again, we've had open meetings for about a year now, but we did want to have the special meeting specifically for this purpose of hearing public input.
Unmuted. Someone's trying to speak.
Okay.
Hi, this is Megan Gary at 133 Butler's Lane. First, thanks for working so hard on this, putting it together, and I appreciate the explanation tonight too, because I haven't been keeping up with it. I think my only comment, the first one, I would feel as a user that it would be helpful to have a brief description of what the historic district encompasses in this document, but perhaps you think that's too cumbersome. So maybe just a reference to where the definition of the location of that historic district is in this document would be helpful. And then my second comment is, I understand a lot better now after the explanation of how you go about, I guess, applying for these COAs. But when I first read section 3.2 letter L on page 4, I was first kind of hit with like, okay, so metal roofs are not allowed, won't be allowed, and I'm not sure that was your intent based on the explanation I heard today. I'm assuming if someone wanted to install a metal roof or repair a metal roof, that they would have to, you know, justify that it's like the Tapestry Beach's pavilion metal roof or something like that. But just to let you know, my perception in reading this seems like metal roofs were just about off the table the way this is worded. Thanks.
Chairman, I'll comment on that. In terms of the boundaries of the district, it equals the B, I'll say 3 points. It simply equals the B1 district. The town zoning map should indicate the location of the B1 district and eventually will also show the overlay of the historic district on, exactly on top of that. But to your point, the designation report has a very brief description of the boundaries in terms of streets, avenues of the B1 district or the historic district. And we can plug that into these design standards. That's not a problem. Now look, I want to comment on this metal roof issue that you raised because with all respect, it shows that I was not as clear as I should have been. When you read L, L is simply saying that if you're going to alter, restore, or erect a medium to dark gray or black asphalt shingle roof, if that's all you're going to do, and that's the type of roof you're going to do it to, then you are allowed to seek approval from John and not from the HPC. And what I mean by that is, it in no way at all has anything to do with somebody proposing to put a metal roof on their house. That would be a major change for which a COA application would be made to the HPC, and the HPC would consider various things in determining whether that change was appropriate or not. For example, if somebody wanted to put a neon green metal roof on a structure within the B1 neighborhood, there's a possibility that they might find that that's not consistent or harmonious. But if somebody was going to put a black or a dark gray metal roof and the surrounding parcels have very similar color roofs and it blended in and it didn't stand out as part of the general feel of that immediate vicinity, then it may very well be that the HPC would approve that COA. So 2 points. One, the list that L is in is simply a list that is not complete and merely serves as examples for minor work from which you can get approval from Mr. Batson and not from the HPC. And the question, again, to be redundant, the question of adding a metal roof would probably be more appropriate since it's not considered minor, it's considered major, might very well require the application for a COA. Does that answer your question?
James, it does provide clarity. I think I understood that from how I read it. It was just that in knowing that L is about minor work that would need this other kind of approval, in it leaving out metal roofs, it lends itself to be inferred that metal roofs would not be, so say I went through the process of having a major change and a metal roof was approved as being harmonious because it matches the community center pavilion, metal roof and that sort of thing, then after that point, I would still have to go through the larger process of getting approval for any kind of restoration of that roof because it does not fall under L, as L is explicit to dark or medium gray or black asphalt roof. That's all. I was kind of pointing out that the reader can infer that.
That's a good point. Again, the list that's in these standards is not an inclusive, complete list. It's an illustrative list of examples. If you go into, if you stick around for the BZC meeting and we discuss the zoning regulation, you'll see that minor work has a very specific definition. And it would just be whether that maintenance would fall into that situation. For example, if the contemplated work does not result in any changes to the exterior feature, it's not regulated. So I don't know if metal roofs are painted or not, but let's assume for the sake of discussion that a metal roof is painted and it's painted black. Query whether 10, 20 years from now, if you want to reapply a new coat of black paint on that, I don't see that that represents much of a change at all to the exterior feature of that roof.
No, I think that the point that I was hearing that she was making was that suppose you did have a metal roof up on there and it's not black or gray, that could you go ahead and repair that? Let's say there was a hole in it. Could you go ahead and repair it without going through the formal major COA type of process? And I think the point you were making is that when you looked at 3.2 minor work, and you have A through R, I believe it is, these are just examples, but certainly a repair of an existing roof, to repair a hole the same way, even though it's not black or gray, let's say it's shiny or something like that, would still be considered minor work.
It may not even, it may fall even short of that. Let me look at something.
What he's looking at right now is it may not need even a building inspector approval for a repair process.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay.
Minor work shall be interpreted and construed to mean ordinary maintenance, minor repairs, and other work which does not involve substantial change in the design, material, or appearance of an exterior feature.
Right.
I just don't know that repairing a roof equates with an erection, alteration, restoration, relocation, or demolition or destruction of that exterior feature.
I would certainly interpret, based upon the definition of minor work, that it would at most be minor work to repair something, at most be minor work. Right. But I think you are correct that if you were to remove a shingle roof and try to put up a metal roof, that would have to go, that would be considered major work and would have to get a certificate of appropriateness, and you'd have to show it's harmonious and consistent with the community.
Good question. Thank you.
Are there any other comments from the public? That's a couple of very good points. I mean, certainly always good to have a different set of eyes look at these things because you tend to miss things.
Are you talking to me personally?
I think
we've
all
had it plenty.
bouts of dyslexia, to say the least. So. Is there anybody else who would like to make a comment before we close the public hearing, or not hearing, but the public input process? All right, very good. We'll go ahead and close the public input process for this meeting. This is not a decision meeting, so this is a discussion of the guidelines. Is there anybody in the physical audience here who would like to make comments? Again, we will have a discussion, I think, during our regular meeting regarding Mr. Batson's comments and recommendations. If not, is let me go down here, make sure purpose of meeting, talk about that, public comment. Is there a motion to adjourn?
Make a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Second? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay, we close the special meeting. Do we need a like a 1 or 2 minute break before we get started on the regular meeting? We'll find it. Go. Okay, so.
You've been muted. To unmute yourself, press star 6.
Okay, so we have to set up differently. Okay, that's it.